Eve, great. This winter solstice eve journal club. I appreciate you coming. We're almost there to the other side of getting more light, so we can do it. We can go get from here to there. So I have several articles of diverse focus today to discuss, and I'm delighted. Although I don't see him now, I was hoping that illustrious Dr. Colby was on. Maybe he's. I saw him for a moment. Maybe.
Yeah, I thought he was on.
I thought he was too. Oh yes, I see his iPad, so that's good.
All right, you can see me if you want, guys. Come on.
That's all right. He features prominently in some of the things we're going to discuss today. But without further ado, I thought I'd start off with a topic that seems to be all over the journals within last month and this month in December as well. And it's tumors that have the YAP1 TFE3 gene fusion. And there's a whole spectrum of tumors that are being recognized that have this genetic alteration. And this happens, and I'd be delighted if anyone with the soft tissue expertise weighs in on this, please feel absolutely free to do that. The first article is out of primarily Europe, but also involves someone from Sloan Kettering, and they describe YAP1 TFE3 fusion, what they're calling clear cell stromal tumor of the lung. And this was in American Journal of Surgical Pathology. And they cobbled together a series of four cases in which this tumor has what they're calling a hemangioblastoma-like pattern and doesn't seem to have a known histopathogenesis, but all the tumors are characterized by this gene fusion. And so it was obviously a retrospective study, and it was from the author's consultation files. And let me get the article. Can everybody see the article okay?
Yeah.
Great.
Yep.
Super. And the deal with this is that all of the four consultation cases that they describe are in women with a fairly wide age range. And importantly, none of them had some sort of underlying genetic syndrome that was known, in particular, something like von Hippel-Lindau. And they go into the history of tumors that have this type of look in the lung with some nice background on various entities that have been described under different monikers in the lung. And talk about those and make a proposal for this name to this clear cell stromal tumor. And just I'll summarize what the clinical types of findings were. They were all solitary nodules, the three of the four, with exception of one of them that arose in the bronchus. And the clinical features are shown here. They ranged in size. One of them was quite large, 9.5 centimeters, and the rest were smaller than that. And we'll get right to the histopathologic findings in these. These are some representative images from them. And how
you
they
scroll your screen down, Kelly.
Oh, is it seizing up? Let's see. Can you guys see my photomicrographs here?
No, we just see the text, articles for discussion.
Oh, goodness. Okay, sorry. Let me see if I can.
Yeah, sometimes you have to stop sharing.
Sorry about that. Is this working now?
Yes.
Perfect. Thanks for letting me know. I'll have to toggle back and forth between that a little bit. But in any event, So this is the just back to the, this is the clinical summary of the clinical radiographic features of these patients. And this, these are the histopathologic findings. And what they describe is that these tumors were predominantly epithelioid, although they did note that there were some spindle areas within them. And the cells they described as kind of variably clear to foamy, somewhat looking histiocytoid or flocculent. But they made a point to say that it wasn't as though they were truly optically clear cells. In most of the cases, it appeared like the cytoplasm was a bit more on the foamy side or flocculent in nature. And they did describe that one of the characteristic features, although I don't know how well it's really depicted in some of these, is that they had these vascular spaces that were predominantly thin-walled, but there were some areas in which there were thicker-walled vessels. And they thought, to someone who does soft tissue pathology all day long, that they had a, quote, in air quotes, subtle resemblance to capillary hemangioblastoma and PEComa, although there were some histopathologic differences. They did note that in some of the cases that there was kind of a nested or packeted arrangement. And so this in passing raises some considerations for something like another richly vascularized tumor, in particular, something like a carcinoid tumor. Let's see, they also noted that in a few cases, let me see if they've had that depicted, yes, that there were very scattered hyperchromatic, somewhat more bizarre looking cells noted, but it was the minority of the cells. They did also note that there was some degree of lymphocytic inflammation in some of the tumors. And then I think they have a PAS stain here. The cytoplasm of these cells was diastase sensitive with PAS staining. And what this figure three diagram shows is this is more of this is more of what they saw typically in these tumors. And these were what they felt to be some potentially misleading features within these tumors, these hyperchromatic cells, the accompanying inflammation. And then in particular, they pointed out, I think one of the cases had a propensity to entrap some reactive pneumocytes, making one think about a epithelial, Maya epithelial salivary type of tumor. The curious thing about these cases was that they really were completely negative for a wide array of immunohistochemical stains, ones that you might expect to work this type of morphologic appearance up with. They were really only vimentin positive, and they showed immunohistochemical staining for TFE3, but a wide variety of markers, including melanocytic markers for your PEComa type of tumors, and vascular markers were negative, as well as things like NSE, TTF1, inhibin, GFAP, STAT6, cathepsin K. They were essentially all negative in all these cases. So they emphasized that this is an important distinguishing feature. They noted that three of the cases by genetic analysis had this YAP1 TFE3 gene fusion. And although the fourth had TFE3 staining by immunohistochemistry, didn't show the gene fusion and had what they describe as subtly different morphologic features. With regard to how these patients did, it was mixed. There were two that are alive with no recurrence of disease after resection. One is a recent case, so it's difficult to, with regard to follow-up, except that case already had metastases apparently at the time of diagnosis. And then the large tumor that was in the mean bronchus continues to have persistent disease. They go into the discussion in some detail of obviously trying to ferret these tumors out from other mimickers of these tumors and say that they really feel that these differ from conventional hemangioblastoma and PEComa, as well as what's also been a hot topic in the literature, and you'll see in some papers in notation, the YAP1 TFE3 rearranged epithelioid hemangioendothelioma. They go at great lengths to talk about how, in contrast to conventional hemangioblastoma, the immunostaining pattern isn't supportive of that. They also say that apparently they're less xanthomatous than one would expect a hemangioblastoma to be, and instead the cytoplasm's more flocculent or granular than that. I'll just go back to that. I think they're trying to get at that there with that particular picture. And of course, from distinction from PEComa, the immunohistochemistry is different from that as well. I mentioned before that the issue of some of these cases looking a little bit trabecular or nested can raise possibility, and of course the vascular pattern can raise concern for carcinoid tumor or paraganglioma, but again, the immunohistochemistry is not supportive of those entities. And renal cell carcinoma metastatic to the lung is, as well as is a concern. Again, immunohistochemistry can help you there. And watching out for this tricky pattern that may raise the possibility of a biphasic tumor. SFT can presumably, maybe in the areas of spindling, suggest a mimicker of this tumor, and STAT6 is negative in these tumors as well. And they caution the issue with TFE3 for those who use that marker a lot or know more about soft tissue pathology, certainly than me, TFE3, like other things that is the greatest thing since sliced bread now is being recognized as being not entirely specific for genetic alterations in TFE3 and can be seen in non-rearranged neoplasm. So just to be careful that that in and of itself does not clinch the diagnosis. So in sum, we've got a new tumor to think about when we have lesions in the lung that have this relatively clear cytoplasm that's predominantly epithelioid. So add this to your list of considerations of things like PEComa and other hemangioblastoma-like lesions. I would very much love for those of you who actually have some expertise in soft tissue pathology, whoever's on the line, or who, if there's anyone who's potentially seen one of these, to hold forth and give us some pearls of wisdom so we can recognize these collectively in the future.
Hey, Kelly, this is Brandon.
Like to clarify. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Tom.
No, Brandon's a soft tissue guy. Shoot.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, this is a classic example of splitters winning over lumpers. To me, I don't see why these aren't just PEComas that have aberrant absence of some of the PEComa markers that normally are expressed. We all know that PEComa marker expression can often be really focal. It depends on how much you decide to stain them and how many markers you try. Melanin A, HMB45, they're focal. You have to search for positivity to find it. You know, why couldn't these just be PEComas? You know, we know TFE3 is frequently expressed strongly by PEComas. They look like PEComas. And, you know, in the old days, we probably just called all these things PEComas. So why aren't they just more PEComas with a sort of a funny immunophenotype? I don't know what the difference is. And it sounds like clinically they behave like PEComas. So just a comment that, you know, I guess I don't appreciate the rationale here for a new tumor designation without more supportive data to suggest that they behave in a way that's different or distinct from PEComas.
Yeah, I didn't, I'd have to go back to the article, but I didn't recollect them talking about targeted agents for this gene alteration yet, but I must admit I may have glossed over that topic, but I didn't see that in there. It would certainly, if someone out there is sitting on a series of PEComas and has material to analyze, it would be interesting to prove or disprove how many of your histomorphologic PEComas have or don't have this genetic alteration.
Kelly, so let me just be clear here. So that I assume one of the authors here is Michael Michael.
Yes, it is.
So he's the guy who described hemangioblastoma of the lung, I think. So we're assuming now that there is a hemangioblastoma of the lung that is different from this. There is this tumor, and then there's a tumor that used to be called clear cell tumor that's now called PEComa. So those are the kind of the three entities.
Yeah, I think so. And they try to parse the splitting of the hairs in the introduction a little bit. And I guess the real rationale for splitting, aside from the molecular, from a molecular standpoint, was that the striking thing takeaway for me was that these tumors essentially are only positive for TFE3 immunohistochemically and vimentin, and that's it. With the comment, Brandon's comment and point well taken about focality of melanocytic markers in PEComa.
I can tell you there's two or three of these sitting in the clear cell box in the collection that I put together.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking. I'm pretty sure we've seen these.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting if somebody had blocks on PEComas to cobble together and see what could be done about finding this YAP alteration. All right, so
that's not a Anya, do we actually have the TFE immunostain? I'm sure we don't. I know we don't have it here.
We do. Arizona. We actually do. And I was actually wondering, did they also do the YAP1 staining? I'm just curious if there are any observations there too. Right. Because we do see a few YAP rearranged tumors now, like the metaplastic thymoma and so on. But I stained a few of those with various results. So I'm not sure if there are any abnormalities in the YAP stain. And we do have that marker too, so we could try.
Yeah, I don't believe they did, and it's interesting because I have a different article for notation that is primarily a soft tissue article, but I included because it had one example of pleural epithelioid hemangioendothelioma, and it's out of the Boston group, and they are looking at the YAP1 N-terminus immunohistochemical stain there. So I suspect that this group, with regard to the paper under discussion, probably is, as we speak, probably staining them from that marker, but it probably wasn't quite in their hands at the time that they prepared these cases.
Interesting.
So I think, and even in December now, I've seen, maybe not related to the lung specifically, but multiple other studies that have been talking about various types of tumors showing various YAP genetic abnormalities. So more to come on this. But I guess the main point is if you think it's a PEComa and you can't beat any melanocytic staining out of it, possibly consider this.
Right. Yeah, but I think the TFE3 is not very specific. I mean, as you mentioned, can be expressed in other tumors too.
Yeah, and that's what my soft tissue colleague here has said as well, is to be careful. All right, good. Mainly, if I see something like this, I'll send it to one of you, I think, is my take home. All right. Any other comments or questions about that one? Okay. So we're going to switch gears here to something that's reminds me of the Matrix. And this is an article. This is a study that Dr. Colby and actually, now that I see it, my apologies to Max Smith. I did not recognize that his name was on there. So mea culpa regarding that. Dr. Hariri has been investigating this technique for quite a while, but this study particularly caught my attention because of the interesting imaging that I'm going to show you in a minute that really seems pretty neat to me. And this study is an attempt to use a technique that does not procure any tissue, but it to see what the diagnostic accuracy is of using this technique. It's called endobronchial optical coherence tomography to diagnose usual interstitial pneumonia pattern or non-UIP pattern in patients. And so what they did was it's a single institution study, but some outside pathologists. And just to explain this technique to you, this EBOCT technique, it's a minimally invasive technique. And what happens is, I wish they included a video or something to show it, but what happens is that they use a standard bronchoscope, and in the working channel of that bronchoscope, they apparently put down this flexible catheter, and they target areas that on high-res CT seem to have areas of interstitial disease. And so they go out to where the bronchoscope stops, and they take this catheter and they push it out further than that into the unknown until it meets resistance. And then they start taking imaging. And as they're taking imaging, they rotate this catheter 360 degrees and they pull it back a certain distance. I think it was about 9 centimeters. And essentially what you're doing is getting this three-dimensional view of the lung tissue that is in the very periphery of the lung that's surrounding a small bronchus. And it's pretty cool. And I'll show you I'll show you some pictures in a minute. But what their study design was is that they had, they took these patients and they did this technique with them. And they probably were cursing at this one malfunction that they couldn't get images on. So at least they included that, so we know that this is a legitimate study. They didn't hide their data with that. And there's some other ones that nothing seemed to work in terms of getting good histology to correlate with things. But then they ended up with 27 patients. And what they did was they had a person, presumably Dr. Hariri, who was the expert reader of these images. And then they trained 3 pathologists in how to read this. And the interesting part, the important part of it, is that pathologists were the ones reading it, not radiologists. And then after the pathologists were trained on how to read these, they looked at the images and they made an assessment as to whether they were UIP or something other than UIP. And then they were, of course, blind. These pathologists were blinded to what the interpretation of the expert reader was. And then they also had pathologists look at the histopathology from a VAS biopsy that the patients underwent immediately after this procedure. And those assessments were independently made of what the assessment of the imaging was. So the important part about this technique is it literally takes only a couple minutes longer than a standard bronchoscopy. And in theory, one wouldn't have to obtain tissue. And of course, we all know that there is mortality and morbidity related to a VATS procedure and cryobiopsy itself. So let me get to the images. They talked about what you're supposed to see in terms of that. And that's in this table one, what you're supposed to see normally and what you're supposed to see in UIP and not UIP. So let's get right to it. So it's pretty neat. This is normal, what one would normally see. So this catheter rotates 360 degrees through this and creates this picture. And so supposedly you're supposed to see kind of this, what you might imagine you'd see histopathologically, this kind of net, if you will, of alveolar parenchyma. And then to compare and contrast that, this is an example of UIP, and we see these areas of dense fibrosis that are replacing where normal lung parenchyma should be. So I think that's pretty neat stuff. And then just to compare further, if you want to know what non-UIP supposedly looks like, I'll go to this. And this let me go to this. This is an example of NSIP. And supposedly you're supposed to check this out and see that it's more of a non-dense homogeneous interstitial expansion than the normal is. Kind of that recapitulation of some people talking about those dusty cobwebs you see in NSIP from the histopathologic standpoint. And so how'd they do? Well, they were pretty darn good. Let me see where the table is. Sorry to go back and forth here. But the non-expert pathologists, when they looked at these after a brief amount of training period, actually did excellently and were able to pick up on the UIP pattern in apparently 100% of cases. And it was quite sensitive for the diagnosis of UIP as well. And so that's something else. And it was really quite able to discern UIP from other types of specific fibrotic patterns. And they got some Kappa scores in there on agreement between the endobronchial imaging and the histopathology, and it was really quite good. It was 0.87 for the agreement between those two. So this seems to be a really promising non-invasive technique that presumably has next to, or certainly lower morbidity and mortality, hopefully, than a VATS or cryobiopsy for rendering at least a diagnosis of UIP or not UIP in patients who the imaging isn't necessarily clear cut. And it certainly has those advantages. I thought it was quite nice that it was pathologists taking an active role in interpreting these images. Maybe we still have relevance after all, even in the absence of tissue procurement.
How are we going to bill it?
I would absolutely love to hear comments from some of the authors and see how right I got the synopsis of this article and any other things you wanted to share about it.
Well, I mean, the issue is the pathologist going to be in the OR with this? Like, we don't like to be in there for cytology. Now, I've always been a little skeptical of this technique. It looks almost a little too good to be true with their little table there. I think that, that might be sort of putting a little lipstick on a pig there. But I will say, just this past weekend, I reviewed another letter from this group. And one of the issues here is you don't get an idea of the character of the fibrosis. And now they're using birefringents, and collagen is birefringent. And with the images that I just saw this past weekend that aren't published yet, so this may be kind of private information, they are able to separate dense collagen of UIP from the less dense collagen of NSIP. And the images are actually even more easy for us to interpret as what you've shown here. To me, there's all sorts of technical issues here. Does the pathologist go in there? Are we reading an X-ray image? who wants to be trained with this? There's all sorts of issues, but short answer is, like you, Kelly, I think it seems to work.
Yeah.
Inflammatory cells, do they have any way to find the granulomas or, you know?
Yeah.
They don't see those, and the inflammatory cells should just show up as gray. They don't show up as the whitish stuff. And in this birefringent technique that they just showed, the inflammatory cells don't really show up. So you're just looking at patterns of fibrosis. But in the thing that I just read over the weekend, they were able to show airway-centered fibrosis as well.
Cool.
And I
was just saying that Dr. Hariri has been presenting these types of, I guess you'd say, on FOSS images at various meetings that we've had over the years. But the thing that really did it for me was this more three-dimensional image. I could really picture things a lot better. So I really, really am enjoying looking at these images.
Now, I was going to say, I'm surprised that radiologists haven't jumped on this instead of, you know, allowing pathologists to review these.
Oh, I know. I think it's a tour de force to have the pathologists be the ones who are looking at these, because this would probably be right in the wheelhouse of radiologists normally.
Mm-hmm. I trained at MGH, and since I started my residency, you know, there was a push to create like a subspecialty called interventional pathology. Wow. I mean, this is very early, but the Dr. Guillermo Tierney from MIT and MGH have been pushing this in other subspecialties in pathology, also in dermatopathology and GI pathology. And they have been working extensively in esophagus and stomach and duodenum. So this is, you know, Dr. Hariri is doing the long part, but I think the idea is just to get better imaging with time. But of course, I agree with Dr. Yi's question that if you don't see the inflammatory cells, I mean, there's some subtle things that you will miss, you know, like fibrotic HP versus UIP or who knows, you know, but in some cases. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if you combine this with some clinical things, you know, you may be able to algorithmically, you know, select cases that need more biopsies or not, you know, or I don't know. It's in the infancy, I will say. Being trained in MGH, I saw this very, I still in somewhat far, you know.
If they're moving towards treating people with a progressive fibrotic phenotype, it might not matter if we find granulomas. I mean, we think that's really important. But I think the clinicians are thinking maybe that's less important these days.
Yeah, Henry, you took the words right out of my mouth. I wonder how much at the end of the day, it seems like a lot of people are getting anti-fibrotics and whether putting too fine a point on it is going to be necessary or not. But anyway, they're certainly pretty pictures to look at.
And how did it compare to radiology, to CT scans?
So my understanding is that this patient set was specifically selected because their HRCT findings were inconclusive.
Okay. Yeah, their figure eight kind of shows the flow of what they did. And if it was a definite UIP on HRCT, they did not do this technique.
Yeah. So. Okay.
Micro CT will actually show you the same sort of structure, but the trouble is that micro CT to date cannot be done in vivo.
So I paid Dr. Colby to segue us into the next article on micro CT, which is, thank you, Tom. That was an excellent segue. This is another article that Dr. Colby was involved in. And again, very, very cool stuff that isn't maybe completely histopathology related, but I think it has some pretty pictures nonetheless. And as Dr. Colby mentioned, there's this technique of ultra high resolution microcomputed tomography or micro CT. And as he said, it cannot be done in vivo currently, or at least that's my understanding. And what this particular study looked at was attempting to understand where anatomical, micro anatomical derangements there are in areas that do and do not have fibrosis in UIP to get a better understanding of what's going on at the leading edge, if you will, or not yet fibrotic areas in the process. And so what this study did was they took 8 controls that were normal control lungs and then they took explanted lungs from patients with known IPF, an equal number of those, and they froze the tissue. And then they did this micro CT and did all this fancy analysis of both the airways and the parenchyma. And they looked at some very specific things with regard to those, how many airways there were, the thickness of the wall, and the area within the lumen with regard to the airways. And what we're talking about in terms of the kind of resolution that they can get down to is that they can get down, when they were looking at airway pathology, it was 13 microns. And then when they looked at the parenchyma, they looked at 7 microns. And they looked at the surface area and the thickness of the alveolar walls to try to better understand what's going on in areas of and without fibrosis in UIP as compared to normal. And I'll just show you some other pictures here that are interesting. And this is what happened. So they took some CTs just as you would of a patient prior to resection. And then they froze the explanted tissue and did this micro CT technique to it. And perhaps Tom can help me with this, but this is a control lung over here. In this panel A, and this is how things look with regard to an IPF lung. And what the takeaway was is that in IPF, the smallest airways are thickened, and even in areas that don't have any histologic fibrosis. So there was that, but then in areas with fibrosis, what's going on is that there's luminal distortion and dilatation. And let me see if I can show that here. I think everybody can kind of pretty clearly see that here. And so it's really that luminal distortion and dilatation that leads to traction bronchiectasis in these areas. And then of course, honeycombing, which we've all kind of thought about and debated and many late nights at USCAP of people holding forth about whether honeycomb cysts are just parenchymal cysts or are they abnormally traction on terminal airways that are dilated but have just lost their connection to the rest of the airway. And so I think this micro CT imaging seems to support the notion that there is a connection of these cysts to being cystically dilated airways rather than cyst within parenchyma itself. But the important thing from this is that in the non-fibrotic areas of patients with IPF, that there are abnormalities, and where the abnormalities are seem to be in these very small airways. So it's interesting to think about in terms of if there is some sort of way to prevent or forestall UIP, should we really be targeting the airways, and the parenchymal fibrosis is just a downstream result of it? And I think that's what is being posited here, and areas for maybe more translational researchers to work on in terms of do we target the small airways rather than focusing so much on parenchymal fibrosis in terms of preventative therapeutics?
You know, it's sort of interesting.
For others, do you have commentary?
I was just going to say what's interesting about that is, you know, 70% of patients with UIP are smokers. That's an airway, you know, that's a toxic effect on the airways first, right? And then a certain proportion of patients have occupational exposures to wood dust and metals and other sorts of things. So it sort of makes sense that the airways, you know, might be the initial site of injury. How that translates into honeycomb further down is always hard to say, because, you know, even if you accept that part of that honeycomb space is a dilated airway, you've lost that parenchyma around it for some reason, right? And that's still, that whole transition is still a mystery to me.
I think these are important observations because we've become obsessed with the presence or absence of evidence of airway damage and what is otherwise UIP, and immediately jump to the conclusion that it's fibrotic HP as an alternative. And I think that's the issue. Whether there's early small airway change, I don't know. They say there's early small airway change in this paper because they took observations from less fibrotic lung, but these patients by definition had late stage disease because they were transplanted. But the notion that small airways are abnormal in IPF is actually really old. Years ago, before most of you were born, I was talking to a guy named Jack Fulmer at UAB about the small airways, because he had studied the airways in patients with IPF in Ron Crystal's lab at the NIH and published on that. And of course, today we dismiss all that and say, yeah, but we define it differently now. And I'd say, fair enough, but 80% of the patients they were talking about are patients we'd call IPF today, I'm quite confident. And they showed very beautifully that small airways are abnormal early in patients with IPF. So the notion is not new. What's new is thinking that it doesn't happen. And in fact, they're almost always abnormal. You just have to look at them. The difference, of course, is at least from a purely histologic point of view, they don't tend to be the epicenter. Like, it doesn't look like that's where the bomb went off, but it looks like the bomb certainly cleared them out. So I think this is important to inform the conversation about fibrotic HP, which from my perspective has gotten out of hand. I mean, a patient who otherwise has UIP and classic features on a surgical lung biopsy at MDD, if the radiologist mentions the term mosaicism, suddenly the patient has fibrotic HP, and we're mystified that most of them have no exposure history. But I don't think it's that mystical. I doubt they have fibrotic HP. So a disease once feared because it was underdiagnosed is now diagnosed all over the place, simply on the basis of whether or not the small airways are a participant, either radiologically or histologically. And this sort of data is helpful mostly, it seems to me, in making clear that that's kind of insufficient evidence for making the distinction.
I'd just make a comment about their technique here. With this technique, they are able to follow the airways down three-dimensionally. So they're really looking much more at the airways than we do. We look at a two-dimensional thing, and I've always had the problem with this technique that, well, the airways don't look all that abnormal in the, quote, normal lung, but we're not looking at the three-dimensional view, and they do actually follow them better than we can.
Yeah, they've been doing a lot of work on three-dimensional changes in these lungs. This is the same group that also did a massive electron microscopy study as well, looking at 3D using EM, which was really very fine work. I completely agree with you, Jeff, about the small airways. And I'm just wondering, do people notice, when I look at a case that looks to me, this is a slam dunk UIP, but some of them have a lot more small airway involvement than others. Although, you know, I'm still calling it UIP. It's not enough for me. You know, it's just so obviously UIP with all the other changes, but the small airways are often involved with fibroblast foci. I make a comment on it, but I still call it UIP. Whereas some other UIP type UIP cases I've had don't have quite as much.
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, I kind of like Kirk Jones' study recently that really honed in. I can't remember the exact details, but basically pressing the issue of airways changes and peribronchial metaplasia in patients with UIP. Somebody else could probably fill in the blanks better, but I think it was in histopathology maybe a year and a half ago or so.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was a good study. They did show that if there was airway fibrosis, they were more likely to be called fibrotic HP at MDD, but that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the problem is that's become the reference standard. So the reference standard is biased. I mean, they were called that because you said that they had peribronchiolar metaplasia, right? And then we show that that predicts for an MDD diagnosis of fibrotic HP, which is completely understandable. But now that that's the reference standard, it's becoming dogmatic and drove a lot of heated discussion for a recent multidisciplinary group I was a part of. And it's frustrating because that's starting to dominate the conversation. And I think it's crazy.
Well, I'm glad to have such discussion over these articles, and I included a fourth article, but I was hopeful that these articles would generate more discussion. So I'm not at all disappointed that we don't have time for the fourth article. I'll just highlight that there was a group that looked at EVV-related pulmonary carcinomas that don't have a lot of acidic infiltration. And the quick take home there is, if you have an individual, particularly a female who's a never smoker and looks to have a squamoid type of lung cancer, think about the possibility of EBV in that patient because they're, and maybe consider working it up for that with ISH, because there may be some prognostic and potentially therapeutic differences in those patients. Quick shout out to Anya and Jen for a SAT-B2 in neuroendocrine tumors publication that they did. And I think there's some other gems along the way in there for your interest in notation and what have you. Sorry to run over a little bit. I absolutely enjoyed everyone's participation in this discussion, and I think it's going to give us some food for thought in how we think about things in general in the future from a big picture way. Any other parting comments?
That was excellent.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, great job. Thanks, Kelly.
Happy winter solstice, and be well.
Happy holidays.
Take care.
Thank you.